Hello and welcome to RoundPeg Podcast. I'm your host, Ali Borhani, geostrategy expert with Family Enterprise Foundation and the managing director of 360 Strategic Advisors. Joining me today from Chamonix, France is Thierry Malleret. Thierry is a founding partner of the Monthly Barometer and Summit of Minds, providing insights to senior decision makers. Previously, he has been at the Global Risk Network at World Economic Forum, advising CEOs and academics to look at how global issues will affect business. He has served a three-year spell in Prime Minister office in Paris and has been the chief economist and strategist for EBRD in London. But lately, Thierry has co-authored a book called COVID-19, The Great Reset, with Klaus Schwab, the founder of World Economic Forum, which has attracted a great deal of admiration and equally criticism. Today, I'll be talking to Thierry Malleret about the world beyond COVID, a great reset, as he calls it. And last but not least, Thierry thinks on his feet. He's an avid hiker and mountaineer. So I'm sure we will go to new summits in this exchange. Thierry Malleret, welcome to RoundPeg Podcast.
Thanks, Ali, so much.
Happy New Year, and I think a happy new decade. What is the great reset in your view? I read your great book, all 255 pages of it. But what is Thierry's version of an unretouched take on the great reset in one paragraph, in 1 minute?
Well, my version is the one that is expressed in the book, of course. It boils down to a very simple message, which is that we are at a crossroads. The pandemic has accelerated many pre-existing trends and exacerbated others. And we have two choices. One is to take the wrong road and to do nothing or not very much, which will lead us to a situation similar to the one of yesterday, but worse, much worse. The other road is the positive one. The pandemic gives us a chance to operate a reset, to fix many things that are not going right and were not going right, haven't been going right for so many years. And we get a chance to make the world, the world economy and our societies more inclusive and more sustainable. So the two big issues that we address in the book are the issues of inclusivity and sustainability.
So when I hear this new term, the new normal, it really gets under my skin, because I don't think we are leaving an old normal behind to move to a new normal. But it is being force-fed to all of us that here, this is a new normal. What is your take on that? I mean, are we leaving behind an old normal? I mean, the disparities, the climate issues, the haves and have-nots. Where is this dislocation in this terminology, you think?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure that everybody, as you just pointed out, agrees with this terminology. It's a cliché. The old normal, the new normal. We don't use these words in the book. It's a normative notion. It's a generalization. A new normal, I guess, defines what some people have in mind concerning the situations that will prevail in the foreseeable future, the coming years. But of course, a new normal is country dependent. It's context dependent. It's ideology dependent. So it doesn't mean very much. It's not a notion that I embrace with passion. I don't think it's very meaningful at all.
Now, in your book, you've outlined four existential threats: the nuclear threats, the climate change, unsustainable use of resources, and the consequences of the enormous differences in the standards of living. What I am missing in this quadrant is cyber pandemics, cyber risks, and this over-dependence on this tech and all things tech. Is there not a risk in techno-capitalism? And, isn't Wall Street and Silicon Valley a toxic mix if we just let it go as it is gaining pace?
Well, we have a whole chapter devoted to this issue. The chapter technology, which is about 20 pages long, is focused on this very issue. And we even quote abundantly Shoshana Zuboff, this seminal book about surveillance capitalism that she wrote, I think, about 18 months ago, if I'm not mistaken. So we are very much aware that the risk exists. It's very hard to tell the way in which this issue is going to evolve, because it's highly regional dependent. Surveillance is not addressed in a similar manner whether you are in China, whether you are in Korea, whether you are in Belgium, or whether you are in the US. Different regions, different approaches. The book was written, of course, from a European-centric perspective, because both Klaus and I are European, even though we try to enlarge our mind. We primarily see and feel what is in Europe. And at the moment, it looks like Europe is quite successfully addressing the issue of surveillance. The policy can do a great deal in terms of addressing the issue. And if you put into place the right regulation and measures destined to ensure that technology will be put to good use and that you'll be able to preserve your privacy, there is hope. And I'm not sure that this applies to all countries and regions across the world. But at the moment, at the very least in Europe, we have some policy measures that allow us to be very, very aware, very much aware of the threat posed by the remark you just made. It is an issue. And in the book, it's not a book about tech, of course, but tech surveillance is a chapter of the book. We acknowledge the fact that the way to contain COVID in many respects depends upon the technological measures that you can put into place in terms of trust, tracing and tracking, etc. Well, as you can see in Europe at the moment, you cannot do anything, governments cannot do anything without having first the approval of the citizens. So I think it's a situation that is very peculiar to Europe, but at least it exists.
Well, I guess that is how do you say, an accurate picture of Europe. But Europe, as you can appreciate, is 440 million roughly, and in a world soon to be 8-9 billion. And you are global thinkers yourself and Klaus, and But in that bigger realm of the issue, how can people live and lead a free and meaningful life, you think, if you go beyond Europe, in a top-down hierarchy that is encroaching? I Guy Debord's book, The Society of the Spectacle, how can people really feel comfortable with this fast acceleration of pandemic bringing this higher tech pressure? I mean, where do you think that is going?
Well, it's a question to which I have no response. And I don't think anybody does. It boils down to issues of philosophy, the way you define freedom, you define privacy. Many cultures have different responses. And it's not for me to form an opinion about what a Chinese or what a Nigerian or what an Argentinian citizen can feel about the issue. It's something which is quintessentially personal, the way in which you define your personal freedom and your right to privacy. And there isn't a universal definition of it. And if there were, and if it were imposed by European standards, we'd be accused of being culturally dominant, which is a fair criticism. Mm-hmm. And I've had a discussion with with Chinese friends, and they have a different appreciation of what freedom is. And it's up to them to decide what it is. So yes, I have a concern, and yes, we're only 450 million people, but at least if we live by this, moral standards that we value, it's already a success in itself. And if different cultures have a different appreciation of this issue, it's up to them to decide how they want to live with it.
Hmm. Now, another area which is close to your heart is obviously climate change, and one of the most important, I think, the common denominator of humanity. And there's been a lot of talk lately in and around, again, bringing back, particularly in a post-COVID world, supply chains and onshoring and moving away from China. And I had a question, Thierry, and I need you to help me with. Every country is talking about net zero emissions, and there's massive amount of capital being deployed by the Japanese and at least current existing administration till another week in the office about onshoring and bringing back. Who will pick up the tab on CO2 emissions of this massive movement of capital, production, manufacturing capacity, one way or another, out of China? In context of climate change, is this a wise move, you think?
Well, I think you're addressing two different issues. One is, supply chains and the fact that until recently, China was a factory of the world. And the way in which it relates to globalization and movement of goods and services, by the way, because services emit carbon as well. When you look at the cloud centers, etc., they emit a lot of carbon. So now the first issue is that we are very much aware that environmental degradation, climate change, global warming constitute an existential risk. It's mm-hmm. a global risk. It's a risk to all of us without any exception. It's a risk. The risk of the Anthropocene. There is a determined willingness pretty much around the world to try to bring them down and to commit to net zero carbon emissions. So the question of whether countries and industries and companies and individuals and all sorts of social units and organizations would succeed in bringing them down is another issue, of course. But you can be absolutely certain that the pressure to do so will be mounting from the younger generation, which is a generation that is going to be most exposed to the mistake made in the past. So what we observed while writing the book is that there is a rising wave of activism, which is incredibly strong among the young generation across the world. You have greater everywhere, in every single country around the world, there's a greater Sandberg, and in fact, many of them. And this is separate from the conversation about China and, many other countries that emit a lot of carbon, industrial countries, the US, China, India. Global supply chains, of course, are one of the culprits, but there are many, many solutions that can be envisaged, some of which we have no idea how they will evolve. For example, reshoring provoked by technology is bound to happen. We don't know what is a particular time horizon for which particular industries, but it is bound to happen. Today, you can produce many, many things closer to home, thanks to 3D printing, thanks to biotechnologies, thanks to many new technologies that are about to engulf the world, that are being moved forward at an extremely fast pace. And it's a different issue than geopolitics. It might be that in the near future, many of the things that we need on a daily basis will be provided closer to home because we can produce them closer to home. And it's already happening in the garment industry, for example. You can see it. It's a fact. So this will decrease the relevance of global supply chains, which you mentioned in your question. Also, there is another phenomenon which has to do with the fact that we are all conscious that we need to consume less stuff. You know, you can consume a lot of good things, arts, culture, nature, that can also provide a great deal of economic value, but they're not stuff. You don't need to import them. You just enjoy them. So it's a question of preference, of societal preferences.
But when we talk about, for instance, the fourth industrial revolution, I see that the word and terminologies we use are very interesting. The latest one is cryptocurrency and Bitcoin farms and vertical farms. And at the moment that you and I are speaking, certain cities are coming under duress and pressure, where MRI centers or healthcare centers are sitting in the dark because of electricity shortages, because a lot of these cryptocurrency farms and mining centers are sucking all the power. Where at the same time, our terminology about agriculture is vertical farms. So I don't know, as much as I am hopeful about the future generation and the next gen, I just think that they are over-dependent on everything technology theory. That is my take on it. I don't know your views on that.
I don't know. I don't have a particular view on that. Technology is such a broad category. What sort of technology are we talking about? If it's well tech technology that contribute to improving our mental well-being, why not? And at the moment, it's a field that is exploding. If it's technology that are fueling hatred on social media, well, it's totally different. We don't want them around, of course. So, you know, what sort of technology are we talking about? There are many, many technologies that are being profoundly positive in terms of societal welfare. I'll just give you an example. The technology that didn't exist up to 3 or 4 years ago was a technology that allowed us to monitor the quality of the air we breathe. Well, today it's a $5 billion US dollars market per year. There is a tremendous process of innovation occurring in this particular space. Today you have Israeli new ventures that are capable of measuring the air quality we breathe at the level of the building. You know, 2 years ago it was a region, 1 year ago it was a city. Now you can have air quality measurement by blocks or floor in buildings. So it's a good innovation, right? We want to know whether the air we breathe is safe or not. So I can go on and on and on, and there are many innovations, technological innovations that are profoundly positive. If you take the example of the vaccines, 5 years ago, it would have taken 10 years to develop a vaccine to deal with COVID-19. Well, today it takes 9 months, 10 months, and it is thanks to technological innovation. So, I'm not embracing technology per se because it wouldn't make sense, but I think it's important to acknowledge that there are some technological developments that are incredibly positive and some that are incredibly negative.
I hear you, Thierry, but I want to challenge you there. Even in the case of vaccines, 18% of the world's population have secured 52% of the vaccine doses that is available right now, and majority of that in the Western world. So I think the speed of getting it faster out there is one thing. The fair distribution of many of these technologies and resources is where I am coming at.
I completely agree with your point, but it's not technology, it's economic policies.
It's economic policies. I think there is a misalignment between policy and innovation and distribution. So I think to a great extent, when we talk about, for instance, we've never had it so good, which we have talked about, you and I, by whose account? You know, I think in many parts of the world haven't experienced a lot of these, you know, endowments and innovations and blessings, as I believe, and I discussed it with you. Case in point, Afghanistan. I mean, you know, we can always just say, oh, it's just one country. But that body of land that we're looking at has been in massive pain. You know, the lower part of Heartland and Eurasia has been going from crisis to crisis. So I hear you on technology and the quality of the air, but you know, if countries find themselves at crosshairs in geopolitics, they can't have even the basics, from clean air, let alone to measuring the, you know, the particles in their own floor, in my opinion. One other thing I wanted to discuss with you is everything that is happening in the States and this, you know, state of shock that everybody envisioned on screens on 6th of January. Is this, do you think, an infliction of social media, as you were talking about it, and just freedom of speech? I mean, Angela Merkel has come out and said he shouldn't be cut from Twitter. Do you think that, you know, moving forward, the technology tycoons and titans should decide who talks and who doesn't? Where is that fitting from your optics, in your opinion?
Well, Ali, you're asking me great questions, but questions to which I'm totally unqualified to respond. In this particular case, I have my own views, you know, regarding what's happening in the US. I think what just happened in the US corroborates many findings that we explored in the book. But, you know, knowing whether banning Trump's Twitter account or not is a good thing or not, my view is irrelevant. It's frankly irrelevant. It's a personal view. It's an ethical, moral view, and I don't think it makes, you know, any sense to express it publicly. One of the big things that I discovered while writing this particular book, and I was, you know, given a chance to interview many, many leaders, is that in an environment like today, where there is an overwhelming level of complexity, mm-hmm. where it's incredibly difficult to make sense of what's going on because you are juggling with so many different issues that interact in so many different ways that are intertwined in innumerable combinations. The only right attitude is the one that consists in being humble when you know, having to discuss these issues and these problems. And one of the traits of humility is not expressing an opinion about which you don't have anything particular to say. So I'm hearing your question. I think it's a very important one. And frankly, I don't have an opinion because I read so many contradictory statements that I have a hard time figuring out whether it's a good thing or bad thing.
And you've watched and you have been rather, very well astute observer of Eurasia and Europe and Russia. Could this be the moment of an infliction in US politics, do you think? Could this move GOP into a new structure? And would this be possibly something that, I don't know, I mean, could this be a mini glasnost for United States? From your view, could the, I don't know, the tech belt and the New York belt separate? I mean, is there a possibility, as wild as it may sound, or do you think that this is just a blip?
In trying to respond to your question, I'm expressing my own views. I mean, the views of the Monty Barometer, not the views of the book that was co-written with Klaus. I think glasnost is not the right metaphor. I was in Russia. I worked in Russia during the glasnost period. And glasnost meant something very specific. Glasnost is when you have a thawing, when the whole population was not allowed to express an opinion. And then suddenly you have this glasnost phenomenon whereby people are being given freedom to express themselves, to voice their opinion. So it's not something that happened in the US. You know, in the US, everybody could be fairly open about their own views. What I'm observing in the US is that the scenario, which, by the way, seemed inconceivable just a few months ago, that Biden would have control of both chambers. So it's a good thing in itself, because it means that he's now probably more capable of deploying the policies that he wanted to put into place during his campaign. But I think he's going to be very constrained by the situation in the US. I mean, despite his victory, the US remains incredibly polarized. It remains polarized because it's been affected by unbearable degrees of inequality. And we address it in the book. You know, we explain in the book that societies that are not built on empathy and altruism and that put forward the values of extreme individualism are societies that are less likely to provide economic and social welfare than others, like Scandinavian countries, for example, or East Asian countries, East Asian nations. So the problems that he's facing are not going to dissipate just because he's been elected. I mean, they will remain into place. The fact that China is growing and threatening the position of the incumbent, it's a fact, whether it's Trump or Biden, and of course it's going to dominate policies for years and years and years to come. So these issues are not going to disappear. I mean, they will remain the same. But the truth is that they'll be dealt with by someone who seems much more and capable than President Trump, that's for sure.
Well, it's interesting you touched on China, but the past week or so, U.S. has been going, reinstating titles, Cuba back to a state of sponsoring terrorism, getting a little bit more tighter with Taiwan on China, with Iran and everything, to the point that David Miliband, the CEO of International Rescue Committee, has called the U.S. policy a pure diplomatic vandalism. Is there an inflection point between U.S. and China, do you think, from your optics, again, not from Great Reset, but or do you think that Biden will really start to heal and to coexist and tackle bigger issues like climate change? Or are we in a new Cold War with China?
Well, I think the biggest issue facing both China and the U.S. at the moment is not to fall into the two-city trap, which is something that has happened throughout history. It's a well-documented phenomenon that occurs every time an incumbent threatens the position of the superpower, of the dominant power. So it's very much what's happening at the moment between the US and China. And it's hard to understand why it would be any different this time. The fact that the two countries are facing issues that are incredibly difficult to address doesn't prevent them to address existential issues such as climate change. I mean, you can compete on many different fronts and collaborate on others, because if you don't collaborate about climate change, well, we're doomed, right? So it might be that the two countries compete with each other in terms of dominance, in terms of power, in terms of trade, in terms of military presence in Asia, but they might still collaborate with respect to climate change, and I hope it will be the case, because if they don't, we're in trouble, right? The two largest emitters of carbon around the world, and we can't progress without them moving forward in terms of finding common solutions.
Now, you have quoted Henry Kissinger in your book, Nations Cohere and Flourish on the Belief that Their Institutions Foresee Calamity, Arrest Its Impact, and Restore Stability. When COVID-19 pandemic is over, many countries' institutions will be perceived as having failed. Now, on page 84 as well, you are talking about and quoting that if government have to resort to using paramilitary or military forces to quell, for example, riots or attacks on property, societies could begin to disintegrate. These two are exactly at the moment the situation in the States, isn't it? They have failed in addressing the calamity of COVID, and they are calling on, you know, extra hard-handed presence to manage this, phenomena that we saw last week on TV. Yeah. Isn't through the optics of Henry Kissinger, this is a very delicate moment for US and for that matter for the world, Thierry?
Well, I guess it is, of course. I think nobody can deny that. Of course it is. And it's been expressed by, you know, concerns have been expressed by so many people around the world and in the US. It's impossible not to agree with that. Of course, it's a very critical juncture. And of course, the US is not out of the woods.
And
no, my you just have to listen to Schwarzenegger viral video to understand why it is such a critical juncture.
Now, one thing I wanted to ask you is that are governments really, how do you say, with all of the things that we see in the United States, Black Lives Matter, the social disparities, the haves and have-nots, and in other societies, I think off the line, I once asked you, if they're so incapable of managing the taxes, why people should pay taxes? Seriously, come to think about it. I mean, isn't there better use of the tax money if they are squandering it and are unable to do their job?
I fundamentally disagree with you on that one. So the argument being used by libertarians in the US that they shouldn't be paying taxes because the money is being squandered.
No, I'm saying the proof of it is the state of infrastructure, the state of healthcare, and the rest of it. I'm not saying don't pay taxes. I'm saying paying taxes that are traceable and have an impact. It's just exactly like greenwashing an environment, right? Some people deploy funds, but hardly anything to measure as an impact and climate change, right? Mm-hmm. So if you're paying taxes, yes, you pay it, of course. I'm saying even if you wish, raise the taxes, but show me the impact. So where is the impact of the money that has been, you know, harnessed from people?
I can see that there are countries in which taxes are being paid in full. And these are invariably countries in which the social fabric is very robust and in which there is trust between citizens and the government. That's the reason why people in Denmark or in Sweden, I don't know whether they're happy to pay that higher level of taxes, but at least they do it.
Yeah, but they see the impact, Thierry. I mean, today in UK media, they were comparing the school bags, the meal and students' food baskets and rations.
Special of a lunch at home, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. So I think it's not about not paying the taxes. It's about what they do with the taxes. Thierry, is there a role for family businesses in such a climate like this? And where would that come from? And how would you see this, I don't know, family, private, public partnerships as such? Because in French Revolution, the families who were benevolent and were looking after societies survived, and the rest really got wiped out. Do you see a growing role in this crazy world we're living for family businesses, for picking up the mantle, or is not something that they should bother with?
Well, for family businesses, there is a tremendous amount of research being carried out at the moment to try to see whether they behave better, they perform better. I think every single research department about family businesses in any university around the world is engaged into trying to figure this out. And of course, family businesses, you know, come under many different guises. There's some good ones, there's some bad ones, there's some highly successful ones, there's some very mediocre ones. But on average, in aggregate, research is pretty conclusive about the fact that family businesses are more respectful of the environment in which they operate. And by environment, I mean the ecosystem of the family businesses. In the book, we devote a whole chapter to shareholder capitalism versus stakeholder capitalism. And it looks like, I don't think it's a definite conclusion, but there is a huge amount of anecdotal evidence tending to prove that family businesses are pretty good at being stakeholder capitalists. Mm-hmm. They treat the employees better very often. And there has been ample evidence of that during the first months of the pandemic around the world. They understand the importance of having good relationships with suppliers, with the local communities. So all in all, I would say tentatively, yes, family businesses have an important role to play because they seem to be, on average, in aggregate, more sensitive to the needs of stakeholder capitalism.
Now, you talk about all of the resets in your book in more ways than one, environmental, technological, and the rest of it. Do you agree that today a great part of our deficit is on spiritual reset, that we need that to go back to the roots, to go back to the nature, to take a holistic look at humanity rather than, just going from one nirvana and one panacea to the other? Shouldn't we go back within? And is there a room and timing for a spiritual reset as well?
Well, that's a fantastic question and a very interesting one. Spiritual doesn't mean only religious, right?
Far from it.
I'm asking that question because in times of pandemic, so in times of deep anxiety, there is always religious renewal. Probably we hedge our risk by tending to become more religious. And then this dissipates after the pandemic. It's been true throughout history. In this particular case, spirituality may take a very different form. For example, one of the big and surprising outcomes of the pandemic has been this renewed interest in nature. And and we have a few chapters that allude to that in the book. It's as if the pandemic had made us aware that nature matters to us. And you know me, you know what I do, and you know how central nature is in terms of my activities and interests. And so it's music to my ears. But in the book, we posit that this interest in nature would be sustained. It can take the form of a spiritual renewal. And today you have an amazing explosion, for example, of people who become tree huggers. Mm-hmm. There is a name in Japanese for that, shirinyoku, forest bathing. And you realize that there is a spiritual link that many people are forging with nature, with trees. And we know why. Trees are important to us. They emit many chemicals that are so critically important to our mental and physical well-being. So there is a reason for that. What I've been observing in Chamonix, where I live and where the Monthly Barometer is based, is that there has been an explosion of ski touring. Mm-hmm. The resorts are closed, so you're obliged to snowshoe or or walk to the top. But it's a very exciting way to work in unison with nature. You enjoy nature to the full when you do that, and it looks like ski touring has gone up by several thousand percent in just a few months. Everybody does it in France, and I think it's true in many other countries as well with mountains. So nature is adding a spiritual dimension to this. We're not yet in the post-pandemic era, sadly. We're very much in the midst of it, of the crisis. But moving forward, I think we'll be much more attuned to the parameters of nature, and that we will understand. And that's a very critical outcome of the pandemic. We'll understand for the first time that the well-being of the planet and the well-being of ourselves, our individual well-being, are two faces of the same coin. You can't have one without having the other.
You have quoted Spinoza, the 17th century philosopher, "Fear cannot be without hope, nor hope without fear."
Yeah.
What is your biggest hope and what is your biggest fear, Thierry?
Well, man, what a fantastic and difficult question. My biggest hope is that we will have learned from COVID and that we'll be able to understand how critical it is to put into place the reforms that are required, needed, to contain the risk of environmental degradation that is engulfing the world at the moment. Mm-hmm. Unless we fix it, we are doomed. So that's my greatest hope. COVID has made it clear that expertise does matter, that existential risk need to be dealt with on a collective basis. So for many reasons, I'm hopeful that we'll have learned from COVID and that we'll be better equipped to address the challenge of climate change. My greatest fear is the opposite. We won't succeed because we are divided, because we can't speak as one, and we live in a very tribal world at the moment, in a very deeply divided world, which is so apparent in the US at the moment. But what's happening in the US is not uniquely a US phenomenon. It's happening all over the world. You know, you have Trumps in so many countries around the world. So many countries are led by populist leaders. Europe is at risk, like so many regions around the world. So that's my greatest fear, that the social fabric that brought us together is unraveling, and that we'll find it impossible to find common solutions.
Well, Thierry Malaret, it's been a pleasure having you on Roundtech Podcast. I don't think we're going to have an event-free and seamless ride this year. I think we're entering a more daunting and more demanding decade. And perhaps your book will come to be a cornerstone of many of the issues that are yet to challenge us. And as a reference that we should go back and cross-check some of these thoughts and conversations soon.
Thank you, Ali. Thank you so much. I'm extremely grateful to you for having me.
Thank you, Thierry.
You have been listening to Roundtech Podcast, brought to you by Family Enterprise Foundation and 360 Strategic Advisors. We hope you liked what you heard today. You can always subscribe to Spotify, iTunes, or other platforms to hear the next conversation and our new episodes as soon as they become available.